This is the Political History of Apollo, a limited series podcast from the Planetary Society exploring the reasons why the United States decided to send humans to the moon and why the nation pulled back after landing only 6 times. I'm Casey Dreyer, the Planetary Society's chief advocate and senior space policy advisor. I'm going to be joined by some of the world's leading experts in space policy and history in interviews originally broadcast as part of our monthly show, Planetary Radio Space Policy Edition. We grouped these interviews together in an attempt to tell a fuller story about Project Apollo, to get beyond the flags and footprints we so often see, and look at the deeper issues, like the political prehistory of the space age, the Cold War, the political opposition and cultural impacts to the nation, and even look at the Soviet side of the space race to the moon. The show is a production of the Planetary Society, a nonprofit dedicated to space science and exploration. So if you like what you hear, please consider joining or donating at planetary.org/membership. This is episode 4, Why It Ended. Project Apollo functionally ended on a hot August day in 1968, 3 months before the first crewed launch in the Apollo program, and nearly a year before the first lunar landing. It was that day, August 1st, when James Webb, the NASA administrator, finally responded to his associate administrator for manned spaceflight, who had sent multiple requests to begin work on the next batch of Saturn V rockets. You see, NASA had contracted to build 15 Saturn V's for the Apollo program. But the immense Saturn manufacturing capability created in the past decade had always assumed that those 15 were the first batch, the first order. Surely, the Saturn V would be a critical component of the nation's space program for years to come. But citing the current budget situation in fiscal year 1967, Webb disapproved the request to begin production on the 16th and 17th Saturn V's, which effectively shut down key production lines for the rocket. And he knew what this meant. This decision, he wrote, limits at this time the production effort on Saturn through Vehicle 515. No further work should be authorized. So 15 is all the Saturn V rockets that there would ever be. After spending roughly $75 billion in today's money to develop and build the most powerful rocket in history, still in history as we look back, it took a mere 72 words written in a memo on a hot August day for the United States to turn its back and walk away. Absent the lift capability of the Saturn V, there could be no further missions to the moon. A program born in infinite opportunity and idealism had collapsed suddenly to become resolutely finite. As someone born long after Apollo, I confess that I struggle to comprehend this point in its story. From 1968 to 1972, the United States had hit the peak of achievement in human spaceflight capability. There was an Apollo mission roughly every 4.5 months. I mean, people were walking on the moon. But during this same period, NASA's budget dropped by more than 25%, and due to inflation happening at the time, its purchasing power was nearly cut in half. I try to remind myself that obviously Apollo was not the only thing happening at that point in history. The U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War was at its peak, and the country was spending more on that war every single year than it spent on the entire Apollo program. I remind myself that Richard Nixon, who had lost his first presidential bid to John F. Kennedy, would have never have supported the moon goal, despite enjoying the public attention from it. I also have to remember that Apollo succeeded in its stated goal. It landed a man on the moon and returned him safely to the Earth before the Soviet Union did. The U.S. had proved its technological and organizational capability over the Soviet Union, and also that the tensions had relaxed between the two countries. I also have to remember that this is when the space shuttle enters the story. It was pitched to be everything that Apollo wasn't. Reliable, reusable, and most importantly, affordable. Each Apollo mission at the time had a marginal cost of about $3 billion and launched maybe 3 to 4 times per year. The shuttle was promising to launch for a fraction of that cost, upwards of 40 to 50 times per year. But still, I struggle. To help me understand why this happened, why the United States turned away from the moon, I spoke with someone who was there, Dr. John Logsdon, currently space historian and author of the book After Apollo, Richard Nixon and the American Space Program. He joins us today. Okay, John, welcome to the show. I want to pick up maybe midway through the 1960s when everything is looking really good for NASA. The funding is extraordinarily high, historically high as it turned out. You have Gemini is wrapping up. It's clear that the U.S. is probably going to succeed at this point by the mid-60s. But politically, there's starting to be a lot of hesitation and critique of the spending levels of the Apollo program. And what I notice is not happening at this point is a real serious discussion of what a post-Apollo world looks like. We had the beginning of Apollo applications as a program, but Lyndon Johnson himself didn't seem to be pushing a post-Apollo future. Is that an accurate way to characterize this situation? And what was Lyndon Johnson's thinking at this point in the mid-60s?
Well, by the mid-60s, certainly by 67, the United States was bogged down in a war in Southeast Asia. There were riots in the cities. The Great Society programs were just getting underway. Johnson was kind of perceiving himself as failing in his presidency. He had no appetite for another big new space program, even though he had been one of the leading advocates for Apollo. He said, that's really something for the next president. I'm not going to run again. I'm not going to run in 68. And those decisions can wait. And so, indeed, they did. There was some funding for Apollo applications, which were basically ideas for using the Apollo hardware to do other things, which ended up basically going nowhere and just resulted in the Skylab experimental space station and nothing else. As the Apollo funding ramped down, the NASA budget decreased. There wasn't a new program initiatives to take up the released funding.
What point did Johnson decide he wasn't going to run again? He must have decided internally long before he said it publicly, but did that have something to do with his lack of direction on the space program throughout this period?
Well, he announced his decision not to run again in March of 1968. But he had made his mind up well before that. There are stories that he told Jim Webb, the NASA administrator, that he wasn't going to run again sometime in 1967. So I think he was not thinking about making decisions that would result in large financial commitments in the years after he would leave the White House. So there just wasn't much forward momentum behind the program. Do Apollo, meet Kennedy's goal, and then let somebody else worry.
Is it as simple as the fact that Vietnam basically consumed his presidency? Because, he really was on the kind of the vanguard of this, pushing space as a critical national security infrastructure back in the late 50s. He who controls space controls the world. I find really telling in a sense that you were there for the beginning of space history, basically, and created this field. You have a book about JFK, and you have a book about Nixon, but you don't have a book about Lyndon Johnson in that middle part. And so it's striking to me that someone who started out so strong would seem, in retrospect, to have such a small impact on the program.
Well, I think there are a couple of things that explain that. One is that once Kennedy decided space was important, he took it back as an issue. He had given it to Johnson as he came into the White House, but he took it back. And basically, LBJ was marginalized on space issues from, let's say, May of 61 on. And then after the assassination, his other priorities, his other responsibilities as president kind of consumed him. He said, either it was an interview with Walter Cronkite or in his autobiography, I'm not sure which, that he spent more time on space as vice president than he did on as president. It just was not very high on his agenda, given all the other things that were.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to say Vietnam consumed it, but I mean, Vietnam was spending an Apollo in aggregate budget every year, and lives were at
stake. Well, and it wasn't just...
Great Society, civil rights.
Great Society, say the urban problems in the 60s. There were plenty of things on President Johnson's plate without worrying about the future of the space program.
Do you think he abrogated his responsibilities there? Do you think he misstepped by not putting his stamp on that in the long term?
No, I don't think so. I think he also recognized that starting something new before we finished Apollo was unlikely to get much of a positive reception. So I think there was a political judgment that it was not something to spend a lot of his waning political credibility in support of.
Yeah. I just spent a whole episode talking about some of the domestic political opposition to Apollo. And would you say that that grew over time, even as the program became more successful? Or do you think it kind of maintained its position and then the support diminished as this program succeeded?
Well, I think the criticisms of Apollo and the sense of misplaced priorities, that kind of argument, started in 63. And I would say peaked in the 66-67 period. It was hard to criticize the program after the Apollo fire, because that means you're criticizing the sacrifice of three lives. So, I mean, the reaction to the Apollo 1 fire is we got to keep going. The reaction was not, oh my heavens, we've lost these three people, let's quit.
Yeah, pull so, the plug after that.
So I think the criticism kind of tempered down in the 67-68 period, peaked in the mid-60s.
What role, if any, did space play in the 68 elections?
Oh, I think it virtually none.
That's fascinating. I mean, again, we're about to land on the moon, and it was...
Well, 68 elections, November of 68, was after the first Apollo human flight. Apollo 7 was October of 68. But in looking back, I don't see it was an area of contention between Hubert Humphrey. Humphrey had been chair of the Space Council as vice president under LBJ, but didn't do much, didn't make space a major Humphrey issue. And Nixon, as he started the campaign, said, we've got to have a strong space program, but it's a place that we're probably going to have to cut the budget. So typical kind of ambivalence with Nixon and his attitude toward the space program. So it really was not an electoral issue of any significance.
As a consequence of that, there was no fear of electoral or political price to pay from the public, right? Like Apollo wasn't driving their whether they would get votes or not, beyond maybe the fact that there were jobs related to it, right? But there was no fear about the politics of it.
No, I don't think so. I mean, Humphrey wasn't going to get votes because of his involvement in space, and Nixon wasn't going to get votes because of his attitude towards space. It just was not an electorally relevant issue.
Coming in to the presidency, what attitudes or what lessons did Nixon bring from when he was vice president at the very birth of the space age, working with Eisenhower? What did he internalize any lessons from that, or did he bring things back to maybe a pre-JFK attitude?
Well, I think, first of all, he hadn't paid much attention to the space program once he left the vice presidency in his campaign for governor in California, and then his retirement, getting ready to run for president again. Space was not central to anything he had been doing. Immediately after Sputnik, he was a strong proponent of a civilian space program rather than putting the emphasis on military, and he was proponent of international cooperation. I mean, the reason he favored a civilian program back in the 57-58 period was so a new civilian space agency could engage in international cooperation. So I think he brought those biases, but they weren't again, very high up on his priority list.
To the extent that he thought about it, I guess. Should we preface every statement about Nixon in space with that,
No, that's not fair. He had a transition team on space that was composed of very senior people that told him major decisions were going to be needed in the first months of his administration. And Nixon did his homework. So I'm sure, read that transition team report and was very much aware as he came to the White House that one of the things on his short-term agenda was post-Apollo space efforts.
What was in that report telling him to do? Was it basically, you need to decide now because we don't have the time to ramp up something new immediately after Apollo? Or was there ever a consideration of just saying, why don't we just keep doing Apollo missions?
Well, I think that the main thrust of the transition team report was that there was justification for continuing a human spaceflight program, but not at the budget level that had been reached at the peak of Apollo and was already on the way down. And I think the transition report said reduce it even more. There were some skeptics of the value of human spaceflight in that report, notably Lee Dubridge, president of Caltech, who Nixon picked as his science advisor. The general tone of the report was, yes, we have to continue a leadership program, but not like Apollo, not on a crash basis, not setting deadlines, and not at a high budget level.
Nixon assumes office January of 69. Great timing.
Six months to the day before the first steps on the moon.
Yes, it's a great timing, right? He doesn't have to politically push that program through. He's doing his own thing at the time. Yet he gets to be kind of the face of the government that's celebrating this achievement. Was there any indication that enjoying that, basking in the glow of Apollo or celebrating the success, changed his thinking about whether space should be a priority? Or was that just kind of a cherry on top of whatever he was dealing with to him?
Well, I think Nixon was quite aware that when the United States landed on the moon, it was going to be a world event, everybody paying attention. And consistent with some of the themes of that he wanted to stress in his presidency, of humanity's unity and peace and goodness for all, and sound like kind of kabobbe there, but there's a quote in my post-Apollo book, Nixon book, from his then speechwriter, Bill Safar, who says he was recognized it was going to be shot in the arm in terms of national morale, and he was determined to be a very visible part of it.
Also, we should just acknowledge, it's easy to look back on this with hindsight and say it would succeed, but it could have easily not, right? There's the famous alternate speech written by, was it Bill Safire?
Yeah.
About what would have happened if the Apollo astronauts hadn't lifted off.
Well,
the moon,
but as he came into office, Nixon was still able to bask in the glow of the Apollo 8 mission at Christmas time of 68. LBJ had the Apollo 8 crew to the White House after the mission, and they found a kind of somber place and him very down. But then Nixon invited them back, and apparently they had a great time. And Nixon and the Apollo 8 commander, Frank Borman, hit it off very well. And Borman became Nixon's kind of chief space advisor with respect to Apollo 11 over the following few months.
I found that really kind of funny because Borman isn't known as a big space booster. He's a very kind of no-nonsense guy, right? Which is maybe why Nixon enjoyed his advice on that. But he wasn't coming in as carrying the fire of space behind him, right?
No, I mean, the issue there was who would Nixon pick as head of NASA? Hmm. Jim Webb had left NASA in the fall. His deputy, Tom Paine, was acting administrator. And the Nixon administration searched kind of far and wide for a good Republican with strong technical credentials to be the NASA administrator, and because of the uncertainty of the future, nobody wanted the job. And people knew that Tom Paine was a space visionary, a space crusader, and a liberal Democrat. His wife had campaigned for Hubert Humphrey. Mm-hmm. Despite all that, kind of by default, Paine was selected for the job.
How important was that NASA administrator transition into ultimately what Could Jim Webb have changed this trajectory at all through his presence and experience?
I think by 1968, Mr. Webb was tired, beaten down, kind of said, I'm done with my job. My job was to get us ready to land on the moon, fulfill President Kennedy's mandate. I don't think he had the appetite to continue political battles. And again, Mr. Webb was a very committed Democrat. He didn't get along with Humphrey, so he said, if Humphrey's elected, I don't want to be there, or he won't want me there. And if a Republican is elected, I certainly don't want to be there.
Yeah. So it seems just like the trajectory coming into 68-69 is looking just very poor for the future of the program. Just baseline, right? The fundamental structure seems weak for continuing Apollo beyond.
Well, uncertain is the word I would use. Everybody recognized that we were coming up on a kind of epochal event with the first moon landing, and that would provide potentially the support, the political excitement for a major new initiative. So I don't think the program was on the edge of collapse kind of condition. It was a very high level of uncertainty.
It just seems like a lot of poorly timed things happened all at once. With the presidential transition happened to be right before the first landing. You had the NASA administrator transition. You had the issues with Vietnam, and then all the other domestic issues really destabilizing the country. I mean, the country of 1961, of JFK announcing Project Apollo, to the country of the moon landing in 69 was almost unrecognizable in some ways, right?
Sure. I mean, we had had the assassinations of the 60s, the urban riots of the 60s, the Vietnam, Southeast Asia bogged down, a president basically being driven from office by public protest. The only positive thing at the end of 68 was the space program, was the beginning of the Apollo flight, and particularly the success of Apollo 8, I think coming in Christmas Eve of 68 and then bringing back the Earthrise photo was a very positive thing. So the program was not in horrible political shape.
I want to introduce you as a character into this story, since you were there following the program, right? And following this as an academic at this point. In your perspective then, right before Nixon came into office, what did you see as the future for NASA at this point? If you can put yourself back in your shoes.
Oh, God. that's a long time ago. And I really don't remember, Casey. I remember what I was doing at that point. I had chosen in 1967, finishing up my graduate work at New York University, to write my PhD dissertation on the foreign policy uses of the American space program. And when I started research on that topic, I realized that everything I was interested in was tied up with the decision to go to the moon. And so I decided to do the dissertation as a case study of Kennedy's decision to go to the moon. So that's what I was doing 67 and 68, early 68, was doing the interviews, writing the dissertation, getting ready to defend it in 68, 69. I think I finished the manuscript just before Apollo 11, or it certainly was almost finished by Apollo 11. I was so tunneled into why we were doing what we were about to do that I don't think I gave much thought to the
right.
future of the program.
Yeah. Let's move into Nixon and the Space Task Group then at this point. So what was the Space Task Group? How did it come together? I think more even interesting, what were their recommendations coming out of this?
As I said, the Nixon's transition team for space said immediate decisions are necessary to keep the Apollo engineering team together, to keep the momentum of the program. To do that, Nixon turned to his science advisor, Lee Dubridge, president of Caltech, former president of Caltech, and Dubridge proposed a blue ribbon committee to take a quick look at the space program and make definitive recommendations on a post-Apollo program. Lee Dubridge thought he would run that committee. He was viewed with skepticism by Tom Paine and others at NASA as being anti-human spaceflight. And so they were able to get to the White House and say, this kind of task force is fine, but DuBridge is not a person that we think is balanced in his judgment or will give us NASA a fair shake, and so find somebody else. The Space Council carried over, National Aeronautics and Space Council still at that time, with the new vice president as the chair. The vice president was Spiro Agnew. I was in a position, he was my governor in Maryland, and he was had been the liberal candidate for governor the year I moved to Maryland, which shows how conservative the Democrats were. Agnew was put in as kind of a substitute chair of this group and called the Space Task Group, but it was still staffed by the Science Advisor's Office, by the Office of Science and Technology, and consisted of the head of NASA, Secretary of Defense, but the new Secretary of the Air Force was the former deputy at NASA, Bob Siemens. So Mel Laird asked him to do the job, the chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission. And so this group began its process in March of 1969 with the aim of having recommendations on a post-Apollo program by September. NASA, of course, had been thinking about its future. It had a very dynamic head of, I'll say manned spaceflight because that's what it was called back then, Associate Administrator for Manned Spaceflight, a man named George Miller. And Miller and his associates had come up with an ambitious plan that involved a 12-person space station, or at least a space station. There was a big debate. Some people wanted a 100-person space station. But a space station as a staging base for outward movement and a reusable logistics vehicle to go back and forth to the space station called a shuttle. That was the program that NASA wanted to get approved. And in fact, Payne tried an end run of the Space Task Group, went directly to Nixon and said, the next step is a space station. Why don't you approve it now or at the time of Apollo 11 and let's just get going on it. And never mind this whole process of that we don't control. That didn't sell. It didn't go anywhere. And so Payne and Miller basically convinced Agnew of the attractiveness and the wisdom of this so-called integrated plan for the future. Payne said, well, yeah, but there's no goal there. It's building infrastructure. It needs a goal. It needs something jazzy. He liked very dramatic, jazzy things. He said, how about Mars as the goal? He had NASA study options for early missions to Mars, and then brought in to present to the Space Task Group Wernher von Braun to present the idea of a mission leaving November the 12th, 1981, aiming at Mars in 1982, late 1982, and returning to Earth in August of 1983. And that was presented in detail to the Space Task Group about 3 weeks after Apollo 11. It was August the 4th, maybe 2 weeks after Apollo 11, and became the core of the Space Task Group report was recommendation of setting Mars. It got toned down when the White House found out what they were going to be presented. In the first version, it was Mars in 82 and or something like that. And John Ehrlichman saw a draft of the report and said, don't give that to the president because he'll have to reject it. Give me a recommendation that he can accept. And the recommendation ended up being Mars by the end of the century as the goal, with all these intermediate steps of shuttles and space stations and lunar bases along the way.
I love this chart that was ultimately presented. And it's just like a fantasy. It's like the Wernher von Braun fantasy from the 50s almost, right? Where you see reusable shuttles, nuclear tugs,
yeah,
you know, 100 crew space stations, mm-hmm. permanent lunar bases, mm-hmm. and then just maybe a 6-person base on the surface of Mars. You know, it's just, I can see why they were excited to do this, right? This is in the midst of...
Well, they just landed on the moon. Yeah, like, hey, we can do anything.
Exactly, right? The most and they just had this huge marshalling of resources and political support for it. Was there anyone on the Space Task Group who was saying, like, wait a minute, like, this... maybe a misreading of the political situation.
Yeah, there was. DOD representative, Secretary of the Air Force, Bob Siemens, wrote a letter to Agnew when he saw what the recommendation was going to be, saying, slow down a little bit. We're not either technically ready or politically ready to take on another Apollo-like commitment. So even within the group, cautions were raised, and the report itself was revised to tone down the language. At least the front of the report was, when the back remained unchanged. And the chart that you're talking about was in the back of the report, still had the mid-80s Mars goals as possible alternatives. But there was so much momentum with Agnew supporting it. Agnew at the Apollo 11 launch leaked to the press. It was a very conscious leak. I think we should go to Mars next. Created a flurry of interest and in probably more criticism than not.
So I can understand Thomas Paine and others in NASA misreading this, but how did Spiro Agnew not understand who he was working for or even read the political situation? They had a couple recommendations for funding levels to achieve this, but one of them was roughly $10 billion a year per year, which is higher than the Apollo peak, sustained almost for the next decade.
Yes. Well, Agnew was not a very good politician. He was out of his element in national politics, I think. He had been a local Baltimore politician and then governor of Maryland for a couple of years before he was plucked by Nixon to be his vice president. Little side note, I have a letter signed by Spiro Agnew, thanking me for helping him support the man most qualified to be president, Nelson Rockefeller. He led governors for Rockefeller until Rockefeller pulled out of the race without alerting him, and it made him kind of a prime candidate to ally with Nixon. He was basically snowed by von Braun and Paine, and drank the Kool-Aid of Mars or nothing.
Yeah. Well, if anyone could mix a good Kool-Aid, it would be von Braun, right, on this. What happens then? They present this to the White House. Does Nixon even read it, or does this go through?
Oh, I don't know whether he read it or not. He did his homework. So his budget director, a man named Robert Mayo, and the science advisor, Lee DuBridge, and he had a special assistant named Peter Flanagan, who came from Wall Street. And Flanagan had a 30-year-old, very bright young assistant named Thomas Clay Whitehead, who actually was the top space policy person in the White House political circle. And they were all skeptical. They let NASA know, as it prepared its budget requests, that it should not assume that the White House would approve anything close to the Space Task Group report, and so should prepare a much more modest budget request in accordance with a slow-paced, not very ambitious program for the 70s.
Yeah. What a modest budget request meant to NASA ultimately was very different than what the budget office thought of.
Yeah, the budget office was talking about maybe a $3 billion budget. NASA was talking about $4.5 or $5 billion budget, which is what they submitted. It was kind of amateur hour in the White House. The White House had all kinds of trouble formulating its first budget. Their revenue estimates were way off. They were trying to put in a tax cut, and they didn't know how much influence that would have. They didn't want to run a deficit. So there were successive ratchets in the NASA, as many and many other, but particularly the NASA budget request, went down to, I don't remember off the top of my head the numbers, but let's say from 4.5 to 3.3 or 3.2 billion before the final budget went to the Congress.
And this was 1970?
This was the fall of 1969 and the January of 1970.
Preparing for the 71 budget.
Preparing for fiscal 71, yeah. And in there were trades that were very interesting. The production of Saturn V moon rockets had been temporarily halted.
I wanted to touch on this. Yeah. The first time I read this memo, there's one I'm thinking of in particular, the 1968 memo from James Webb,
yeah,
which is on the procurement of
long lead time items for Saturn.
Yeah, and it was basically saying, we're not going to produce any more first stage Saturn rocket. We're not going to start the production lines for any more beyond the 15 that were ordered for Apollo.
Because there's no program
to use them.
To use them.
Yeah. And so like in 68, this is the summer of 68, I think.
Yep.
Before Apollo even started, before the first human launch of Apollo 7, the program had functionally ended, right? The hardware wasn't going to
unless
be there.
Unless the decision was reversed. The program had functionally ended.
Yeah, and reverse quickly, right? Because that was part of the problem, that you either sustain some big standing army cost of engineers sitting around doing nothing, or they disperse and...
So the Nixon transition team had pointed this out.
Yeah.
And it said you probably should invest in sustaining the ability to produce Saturn V until you make a decision of what you want to do post-Apollo. When you get to the budget formulation, you now had Apollo 11 and Apollo 12, which was November of 69. Nixon was already saying, I don't see any need to go back to the moon six more times. He was not a fan of continued lunar exploration, even early on. NASA wanted to get started on studies for the space station and, incidentally, the shuttle. The station was the top priority, not the shuttle.
So when did the Saturn V production functionally end then?
The budget people Nixon made an offer to Payne that says you can either restart Saturn V production or get started on these new programs. You can't do both. Payne, oriented toward the future, said, if I have to, I will give up Saturn V. And that was in the proposal that went to the Congress in February of 1970. So within 8 months of landing on the moon, we basically threw away the capability for future exploration.
It's truly hard for me to understand that thinking. You point out in your book that the nation had spent tens of billions of dollars the Saturn V was, I think, roughly half of the total cost of Apollo, all the Saturn family of rockets, the F1 engines. That was the launch complex. Yeah, right. Yeah, all the associated capabilities and infrastructure. And they were done after 15 times, roughly.
Well, not even 15.
Yeah, right. It's true. Yeah, there's a couple extra. But what was there any hand-wringing? Like, did Wernher von Braun, did his head explode? Metaphorically, how was there not some sort of national awareness or conversation or thought about this at this
point? Well, I think it's reflective of the national mood at the time. And it was part of the problem of Kennedy defining Apollo as a race to the moon. We had won the race. There was no compelling reason offered to continue a program of lunar exploration after having done what Kennedy told NASA to do. It was clear that the Nixon administration was not going to approve a program of continued deep space exploration that would require the Saturn V. So there was no requirement for that capability. And in the public mood of the time, Nixon said to Tom Paine as they discussed these issues, I'm hearing from the public that they don't want a continued strong, ambitious space program. And so I don't think politically I can approve anything.
And that was correct too, right? Yeah. There was never a strong public demand for this.
But the public interest in Apollo peaked with Apollo 11 and very quickly disappeared. Mm-hmm. One remembers that by the time of Apollo 13 in April 1970, it wasn't carried live on television until the accident. Attention span was very short.
Yeah. It almost seems like a different era in terms of lobbying and investment. Boeing and Rocketdyne and Grumman and all these contractors who stood to gain or lose financially seemed completely out of the picture on this whole discussion.
Yeah, there's no evidence that there was a lobbying campaign, a campaign by the aerospace industry. There weren't organized groups in support of the space program. So the Saturn V was allowed to die with a whimper, betting on the future, betting on the station.
Right, and station serviced by a space shuttle.
But station was a top priority. Shuttle was really not center to the argument in 1970.
Thinking about this the other night when preparing for this interview, and it seemed like there was just this overwhelming desire to say, all right, we've gone to the moon. Where do we go next?
low Earth orbit? Why was that the big step? I never quite understood why that was the
focus. It wasn't going to low Earth orbit. It was going back to the quote right unquote way to do a space program, which has been called the von Braun paradigm, but it's not only von Braun, which is that the first step in a long-term sustainable program is learning to operate in low Earth orbit and then gradually moving outward. By setting the moon before the decade is out deadline, Kennedy had jumped over that step. So what was being proposed was going back to basically starting over.
The station serviced by a shuttle, I mean, that was in your Collier's article.
Yeah. By this time, George Miller had left NASA or was in the process of leaving NASA, but his vision of this integrated plan of station and shuttle and tugs and all of that lived on. So I think it had captured the support of the senior people at NASA, that this kind of future program was a more important priority than continuing Apollo.
It is telling that, unless I haven't seen it, which is very possible, but I've never seen like a New York Times editorial or anything at that point saying the U.S. has invested so much in creating this capability. How dare we just throw this away and we just waste all this money? Now it's truly a waste. But there didn't seem to be any public hand-wringing about this decision at all.
Certainly not much.
And almost as a consequence of, as we've talked about before and in other episodes, the reasons for Kennedy's call for Apollo, because it was very top-down, because it wasn't in response to a big public grassroots demand, when that shifted, when that changed, there wasn't some big public demand waiting in the wings to step in and sustain it.
No.
Right? Like NASA had never cultivated that really to the point where that could sustain itself.
I think that there was a certain arrogance, maybe hubris even, among NASA that look what we did for the country. We got Armstrong and Aldrin to the moon, Conrad and Bean. The country will love us. Whatever we decide we would like to do, it will be supported. And it came as a very rude awakening, I think, in these late months in 69, early months in 1970, that support was not there, that they were dealing with a White House that wanted to cut the budget, that had no stomach for Apollo-like initiatives, that wanted a good space program, but one at significantly lower share of the federal budget. Also, we didn't have a competitor. There was no driving need for an ambitious program. I think people said at the time, Mars will always be there.
Right. And the Soviets clearly weren't in a position to really challenge us on that at that point.
Well, by that point, the Soviets had tried twice and failed twice to launch their big N1 rocket. So we knew from our intelligence capabilities that they were basically out of the race.
So going back to the 71 budget negotiations where NASA had to trade basically what it had for this promise of the future, is that also when they gave up Apollos 19 and 20, or had those already fallen by the wayside by that point?
That was more the next budget negotiations later in 1970. It's a fairly complicated story and worth talking about. There were people in NASA, most notably the director of what was still the Manned Spacecraft Center, later Johnson, Robert Gilruth, and his deputy, who became NASA Deputy Administrator, George Lowe, who recognized that Apollo was operating right on the edge of its capability and was an extremely high-risk operation. They didn't fight very hard the idea that maybe they should quit while they were ahead. And then they get a budget mark, a budget target from, it was right then that Bureau of the Budget became Office of Management and Budget. So it's a transition from BOB to OMB, I'll say OMB from now on, that said there's no way they could afford an ambitious program. And even if they needed money for the space station, they'd have to cut something else. Cutting two Apollo missions reduced the risk and saved a lot of money. And it was NASA that came up with that proposal. It was not the White House. You know, the White House gave a budget context that, that kind of forced NASA's hand, but it was NASA that said, we're going to cut one of the remaining missions without the lunar rover.
The original Apollo 15.
Yeah, original 15 and 19. 20 had already, when it was clear that Apollo was going to succeed in getting people to the moon, 20 had been canceled and its booster reassigned to become the Skylab space station. So that was already done. So 20 was already gone. So what was canceled was then 15 and 19, and the remaining missions were numbered 15 through 17. And that was September of 1970.
Obviously, there must have been reaction part of that to Apollo 13, right, which was in that spring.
Yeah, I mean, that just reinforced. So again, play the dates out. Apollo 13 was April of 1970. The decision to truncate the program and cancel 15 and 19 was made in the summer of 1970. So 13 just dramatized the risk that, that the NASA human spaceflight leadership already was very much aware of.
I mean, I think that's a really important point to just dwell on a bit here because, I mean, we're looking back. I mean, I grew up in an era where people had always walked on the moon, right? And you look back and say, oh, they were successful and they had this near catastrophe, but they pulled it off. We forget that every time they landed, there's always some problem, right? That every mission wasn't free from problems.
No mission was free from problems.
Right, yeah. It was extraordinarily dangerous. And so, and if you just look at the numbers, one out of seven missions failed, right? Which is a pretty high, potentially.
But at least it didn't kill the crew.
Yeah, but it still, it almost should have, in a sense, like this, by how bad it was. It's fascinating to see people inside of NASA basically saying, this maybe, let's, you know, this what you just said, like it's quite well, we're ahead. But Nixon was kind of shaken by this.
Nixon
as well.
Was very emotionally very vested in the fate of the Apollo 13 crew and ignored, according to Henry Kissinger, ignored his foreign policy issues by focusing on the conduct of the mission and getting the crew back safely. He was already skeptical of the value of continued lunar exploration. This just reinforced that skepticism. Maybe it's getting a little ahead of the story, but he tried very hard to cancel 16 and 17 also.
Nixon did,
yeah. He kept telling his advisors, we don't need to do this, let's quit. And then when he got close to 72 re-election, he said, no missions. I'm not going to risk anything like Apollo 13 right before my re-election. So no missions before the election.
And this is why Apollo 17 happened in December
indeed.
Of 72.
Yeah, and Apollo 16 was moved forward a couple of months, I think, till April of 72 to keep it away from the election.
That's a good reminder that politics was never that far from why Apollo was happening or what was going on. The program is being trimmed. The budget's going down. There was never, it sounds like, any serious discussion of saying, what if we just don't do anything and just keep doing what we're doing? And in a sense, that would almost be the cheapest way because you wouldn't have a new development program. You could just keep landing maybe a couple times a year, go all different parts of the moon, slowly increment it. Why?
There were some people.
There were some people saying that.
That said, that kind of status quo program, flying with longer times between Saturn V launches, like 9 months between launches, so that you could extend the program out through the mid-70s and maybe the budget situation would be better by then and you would have some new hardware under development. But that didn't get any traction.
Is that basically what the Soviet space program did from the 70s, like the small incremental changes, like nothing drastically new? They just kind of kept the capability they had and slowly improved it over time.
The Soviet program in this time period made a fundamental shift. It gave up on trying to go to the moon.
Yeah.
And said,
well, once they had like a proton and Soyuz is what I was thinking.
Yeah. Right. But they gave up on developing their N1 moon rocket and an ambitious Soviet program and took what they had and began a program of Earth orbital modest space stations, with the Salyut space station, which extended through the 70s and the early 80s until Mir in 1986. So the Soviet Union once it had lost its the race to the moon, lowered its ambitions and was still a strong space power, but not competing with the United States. In fact, they competed in a different way. They started flying well before we did, mm-hmm. non-Soviet cosmonauts,
right.
visiting cosmonauts, right. and they began to use it as a tool vis-a-vis their satellites, their allies.
You've described something that you characterize as the Nixon space doctrine. And if I remember correctly, it's not formalized necessarily as such, but you've kind of condensed what that attitude of the White House was at this point. So when did that really come into being? Was that the 70 budget? And maybe just like discuss the 3 points of that.
The term Nixon space doctrine is mine.
Mm-hmm.
Nixon never gave a space speech in his...
How, beyond just the Apollo congratulatory.
Yeah. I mean, you know, ritual ceremonial speeches, but nothing the equivalent of Kennedy at Rice in 1962. Finally, the White House, in reaction to the September 69 Space Task Group report, issued a statement on March the 7th, 1970, and it said, here's what we intend to do in the future. And laid out some initiatives and said space has to take its place as one of the things that we do as a normal part of our life and adjust and compete in priority with everything else that we want to do and not be a series of expensive, highly energetic jumps. So that's what I call the doctrine, is space is a normal part of what government does, competing for budget priority with everything else. And in that competition, from Nixon on, it has settled at a level, one-fifth, one-tenth now, the level at the peak of Apollo.
Yeah, you say that the day-in, day-out activities, right? That it's just part of what the government does. And by restructuring it that way, the kind of the trade space of what NASA could do was substantially diminished, right? So let's maybe move on, closing out here, to what became the paradigm of the human spaceflight program up until just a few years ago, which was the space shuttle. You were talking about here how the space station was really the goal. NASA's been wanting to put up a space station. The Skylab is kind of a test station that you're stuck on top of a Saturn booster. How did we get to the shuttle first before that? And why did that end up dominating everything?
Well, if one goes back and looks at the congressional justifications for the NASA program in 1970. There's one program that's called Station Shuttle. Tom Paine, disappointed by all of this, left NASA in September of 1970. George Lowe became acting administrator in September of 1970. And Mr. Lowe was much more politically sensible than Tom Paine had been. Very good engineer and very judicious in his judgment. During the fall of 1970, going into the spring of 71, it became clear that NASA was not going to get approval for the space station and the shuttle together, and basically had to pick one. The judgment was made, and I think it was the correct judgment, that a station without the shuttle was not viable because of the economics of operating it would drive the cost too high, but that you could have a human spaceflight program with the shuttle without setting a major goal, that the shuttle could do a wide variety of things, that it was attractive to at least some in the military, and that there could be a case made for the shuttle independent of the space station. We're giving up on the space station. We're just deferring the space station and developing the two sequentially with the shuttle first. So Mr. Lowe's contribution, I think, was adopting the policy beginning in the fall of 70 that the program that NASA would seek approval for was the shuttle.
Could they have called the Nixon administration's bluff? Because, I mean, fundamentally, you also, I think an important aspect of this is that some of the internal memos you have from the Nixon White House is saying that, you know, that we don't want to be the presidency that ends human spaceflight now that we've done it. That had to continue. They took that as a given. And so,
plus Nixon liked astronauts.
But yeah, right.
I remember John Ehrlichman in a 1983 interview telling me that they were the sons that Nixon never had.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. The visible, right? The kind of the symbols, right, that he wanted. Do you think NASA could have called his bluff and said, look, we can't do anything at this level. We're going to cancel all the human spaceflight. We're just going to focus on robotic probes. Do you think they could have then gotten something better, or were they really facing down the barrel of the gun here, so to speak?
I think they made a political judgment. I think it was the correct political judgment that there was insufficient support at the White House level for the kind of program that might have resulted by calling NASA's bluff. And again, Lowe wrote a letter to the deputy director of OMB in the fall of 70, who was Cap Weinberger, saying with the space shuttle, you could have a continuing program of manned spaceflight, human spaceflight, and not set another major goal. And I think that, you know, in a sense, that played the face card. If NASA tells you that, OMB is certainly going to say, well, okay, let's do it, but let's now start putting the squeeze on the shuttle. Let's make it cost effective. So there's economic analysis got applied to the program beginning in 1970 to show that it was cheaper than continuing to use expendable launch vehicles. And NASA decided that it had to have national security support for the shuttle. So the shuttle had to meet a set of rather demanding national security requirements, which largely determined the design of the shuttle as it finally turned out.
Yeah. This is a complete inversion from how human spaceflight was really perceived at the very beginning, and particularly in 61 under Kennedy, where we had to do this big thing to show off our capability, to show up our technological rival in the Soviet Union. And there's one or two ways that we can do that. You chose that one way, it's going to the moon. Now NASA's doing this day in and day out competition with everything else in the federal government to show, here's what we can do for you now,
right?
And so they have to shop around for customers and shop around for their raison d'etre. So, we can launch DOD payloads. We can launch things into space more cheaply. We can eventually maybe make a space station, but we're building a capability. It's like building a highway system as opposed to...
Yeah, it's building infrastructure.
Yeah, it's an infrastructure project. Yeah. And there's also maybe just to... We don't have to dwell on this, but also kind of a political reason that Nixon wanted to go with the shuttle, right before the 72 elections.
Yeah, but there's a lot that we have to talk about before we get to that. I mean, the shuttle that NASA was trying to sell in the fall of 1970 was a fully reusable two-stage shuttle with a 747-sized booster stage and a, these days I would say, a 767-size upper stage. So it was a big thing they were still, and they thought they would take maybe $10 billion to develop, and the OMB said, well, you can maybe have five.
Right.
This was May of 71. And at that point, NASA was faced with another dilemma, not enough money to develop even the one thing we wanted to develop. What do we do about it?
Mm-hmm.
There were proposals to just give up on the shuttle, stretch out the rockets we have and do a very modest program, or give up on the full reusability and build a shuttle with the upper stage turning into the orbiter, which will be reusable. And then you have to figure out how to get it into orbit.
Mm-hmm. So basically what was driving the design, and again, just in comparison to Apollo, where that you had the goal, then the design met the needs of that goal, right? You need to get humans on the moon, bring them back safely. So that drove all your design decisions, engineering decisions. This was being limited by
budget.
And fundamentally, which is an arbitrary concept based on who is the budget director, what the president's priorities are, what the economy is like, right? So they're trying to do their engineering trade space in this shifting arbitrary field where someone says, this sounds like too much, right? So this, you fit to this. And so the idea of this fully reusable shuttle was undermined. See you then.
Well, undermined once they got that budget mark. As their studies progressed, end of 70 to start of 71, they were still studying two-stage fully reusable until May of 71, when the first budget mark for the fiscal 73 budget, would it have been, I think, came out. The budget that would be decided at the end of the year. And it was totally inadequate for the thing they wanted to build. Then everybody became a shuttle designer. But you still had to meet the DoD requirements, 15-foot, but in particularly 60-foot-long payload bay, so you could launch large reconnaissance satellites, delta wings, so you could maneuver on reentry to get back, basically, back to Vandenberg Air Force Base on the West Coast, which is where you had launched from, but in one orbit, it would have moved 90, how many miles? 1,000 miles. And so you had to be able to maneuver sideways to get back to that secure landing spot. And you had a particular amount of weight to get into polar orbit because of these intelligence satellites. There were requirements that drove the design, and there were budget limits that drove the design. And finally, somebody figured out, well, if you threw away the fuel tank and used solid rocket strap-ons and reused them as much as you could, that you could make the economic calculations fit. You could project that you could launch this thing develop it for $5 billion and launch it at 10 or 14 million a launch, were the numbers that were floated around as the time for decision approached in the fall of 71.
Was there any sort of public or cultural reaction to this idea of a reusable shuttle? Or is this, you know, was this kind of an idea that was being hashed out broadly, or was this all very internal inside of NASA at the time?
No, it wasn't internal to NASA. NASA had study contracts with the major aerospace contractors, Grumman, by this time North American Rockwell, McDonnell Douglas, to study shuttle designs. So it was being hashed out inside the aerospace community. I don't think there was a public debate because we were still doing Apollo missions, after all. Apollo 15 was the summer of 71. This was a debate internal to the space community. OMB was very much involved. The science advisor, by now a man named Ed David, and his staff were very much involved. I was writing an article for MIT Magazine Technology Review right about this time, 1971. The title of the article is "Should We Build the Space Shuttle?" Mm-hmm. And I was in good contact with the staff at the White House Science Office, and I showed them a draft of the article, and the guy named Russ Drew, he said, "You better wait a little bit. Things are changing very quickly." That was right as the article was talking about the two-stage fully reusable, and it was right as NASA was coming off of that and moving to advocating the single-stage strap-on design.
So what were your feelings then about it at the time?
Well, I'm a product of the Apollo generation. I like human spaceflight. I wanted it to continue. And if this, and the proposition sounded very attractive, lowering the cost of access to space. I could look back at that article and see what I concluded, but I'm pretty sure I said this shuttle is something the country should do.
Yeah. The shuttle as proposed was pretty different than the shuttle as manifested, ultimately.
Well, yes and no. Shuttle, as it turned out, was designed the way it was designed in 71. It just didn't have the economics.
Right. The launch rate never quite.
Well, the operability, I guess, is the jargon word. This was back when we were going to launch 40, 50, 60 a year, and airline type operations,
right,
and all those kind of illusions.
Yeah. I mean, you're the one who wrote the paper of Space Shuttle, a Policy Failure,
yeah,
right? Which is true, right? It did fail in its policy goals beyond just the engineering aspects of it. But going back again, just to look at this, to think of this as kind of a capstone of the Apollo era, this future has been kind of focused down to a point where shuttle seems to be, everyone kind of got in line behind the shuttle, or else it seems like they left the agency. And I'm thinking about this Dakota von Braun here. Did he leave because of his frustrations with the end of the moon program? In some ways, it's a very tragic end for someone who his life was this dream, and he made so many compromises for this dream, and then at the end, we just decide to stop
at
the end of it.
I think after Apollo 11, von Braun was tired. He was tired of running a large organization. He got along well in his visionary manifestation with the fellow visionary Tom Paine, And Payne said, well, come to Washington and be our planner for the future. And von Braun agreed to do that and came up to Washington. And then Payne left. And his successor, George Lowe, was very representative of the Houston culture, deep roots in the Manned Spacecraft Center. They, Houston and Huntsville, had never gotten along. Basically, Lowe was not very interested in using von Braun and marginalized him. And the reality was von Braun had some serious doubts about the shuttle design that was emerging, that it could meet any or all of the promises that were being made. I think a combination of fatigue, being marginalized, and not agreeing to the company program, if you wish, caused him to leave the agency, as you suggested, kind of sadly. I mean, you know, this man, whatever you think about his total background, was one of the four or five people responsible for getting us to the moon.
So at this point, you know, NASA finds this kind of compromise design that fills out all these obligations they have to the military, to the budget office, and so forth. What is the final kicker that makes Nixon support it? Was that pretty much it? Did he make this decision? Did his advisors recommend that he make it?
It's one I think we'll never know. The end game was November, December of 71, and then New Year's weekend. It was clear that a decision on the shuttle had to be made. And Nixon, in discussing that, said, well, it's going to produce a lot of jobs in California, isn't it? By this time, the taping system was in, so this stuff is on tape. You know, he's talking to Ehrlichman, and he says, jobs, that's what it's about, is jobs. He was concerned about this. Again, you have to go out a bit in context. His opponent at that time was Ed Muskie. He, Nixon, was behind in the polls in the fall of 71, and California was a critical election state. And he said, you know, there was a California jobs project in the White House looking for ways to create new jobs in California across the board. And the shuttle and making sure that the shuttle contract went to a California firm was key to a lot of job creation. And so I think the final decision was driven by the reality that whatever else its merits, it would also help Nixon's reelection by job creation. But then the White House Science Office came in with an alternate shuttle design to NASA's, which somehow had been suggested to them by the one or more contractors, which, again, in doing my research, I could never get anybody to admit who it was. But all fingers kind of point at Rockwell, which is ironic since Rockwell ended up building the full-size shuttle. So there was a smaller shuttle, which Nixon approved in early December, and NASA loudly protested. And the rest of December of 71 was spent arguing between the NASA full-size shuttle, full-capability shuttle, and this smaller version, with a few other alternatives kind of floating around the edge. But those were the two main contenders. And it finally came down at the very end of the month to a decision of whether NASA would, what size shuttle NASA would build. NASA came in and said, we still think the full capability is the right one to build, but one a little smaller is still acceptable and can let us do most of the things we want to do. Which one, OMB, will you approve? And it's George Shultz was the head of OMB, Weinberger, his deputy. Shultz said, go away and let us think about it over the weekend. Come back on Monday. Monday was January the 3rd, I think. And NASA went back to OMB and were told, we're going to go with the full-size one. NASA walked out of the meeting amazed. It was very much a surprise that they had gotten permission to build the shuttle that they actually built. Whether Nixon was involved over that weekend or whether it was Shultz, Weinberger, that made the decision to over the protests of the science advisor to go ahead with the full-size shuttle. Schultz knows, probably, and he's still alive, but he won't talk about it. The decision was announced to NASA January the 3rd. Nixon was out on the West Coast. They said, fly out to the Western White House in San Clemente and meet with Nixon. There's a classic picture of, by now, NASA Administrator James Fletcher and Nixon looking at a shuttle model. Once again, a statement was issued that said the president has approved the shuttle. We'll take the astronomical cost out of astronautics by routinizing access to space, or some words like that. Nixon didn't get up and announce it. In a sense, the rest is history.
Yes, literally. Was there an awareness at that point? I mean, was it seen as that this was the end of deep space presence for humanity for the next half a century?
The half century, I don't think. But Nixon issued another statement as Apollo 17 left the moon, which was December of 72. So again, 12 months after approving shuttle. And he said, this is the last time in this century that humans will walk on the moon. So saying that in 72 is basically a 30-year forecast, which by his decisions he made true.
Quite true. It wasn't even close, really.
Well, we're not. we're only 250 miles up in 2019.
Yes. And I remember, it wasn't Gene Cernan, it was Jack Schmidt, who felt, I think it was written about, being profoundly disappointed by, he was still on coming home from Apollo 17 and seeing that this is the last of the century.
Yeah. Seeing Nixon's statement.
Yeah. And that seems like a fitting coda in a sense to all of this, that in response to the greatest achievement, I would say arguably of human spaceflight, the response was to lessen our ambitions.
Lower our sights.
Yeah. Fundamentally, do you think that was a function of the political and cultural expectations at the time? That was a period, I know that ultimately Jimmy Carter talked about the malaise and
Casey, this is a tricky question. Was it a good thing to go to the moon in the first place?
Yeah.
Maybe the mistake was skipping all the intermediate steps and going on a crash basis to the moon and using up that destination, creating the expectations that this was what a successful space program was about, was deep space exploration. I don't want to believe that because I was there. I was a close-in observer of the Apollo program, went to three Apollo 11, Apollo 14, Apollo 17 launches. So they were grand things. Were they mistakes in the grand scheme of human progress? Yeah, you could argue it, but I don't want to.
I mean, it's almost like the formulation of Kennedy's statement has almost slipped. We go into low Earth orbit and we do space stations and the other things, not because they are hard, but because they are easy.
And because they're perceived as useful.
Yeah, maybe that's more the practical thing. Dr. Logsdon, thank you for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure.
The Political History of Apollo was edited by Matt Kaplan and hosted by me, Casey Dreyer. It is a production of the Planetary Society, a nonprofit organization dedicated to space science and exploration. Anyone can be a member, so please consider joining the Planetary Society at planetary.org/membership. Your membership enables us to create projects like this podcast, as well as pursue our ongoing work in space advocacy, education, and technology. If you are already a member, thank you. Seriously, thank you. I want to also thank all of the guests on the show for their time and expertise, and to the band Wax Fang for the use of their song. If you enjoyed this show, please review it and share it with your friends. You might also like to check out our weekly podcast, Planetary Radio, and our monthly podcast, Planetary Radio Space Policy Edition. You can find both of them on all major podcast platforms and on planetary.org/radio. Stay tuned for our next episode. See you then.